Dan Vetta is a writer, editor, and literary historian living in Washington, D.C. He is author of the poetry collection The Space Between Our Danger and Delight and the editor of the gay culture journal White Crane. His poetry has appeared in various journals, including Beltway Poetry, Cutthroat, Delaware Poetry Review, Gargoyle, and many, many more. He is the co-creator of the literary history site DC Writers Homes and chairs the board of Split This Rock Poetry. Dan Vetta, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
It's a real pleasure.
And congratulations on your prize-winning book, Speaking Weedy Weedy. I love that title. First of all, you have to explain to our readers who don't know what Weedy Weedy is. What is Weedy Weedy?
Weedy Weedy was a word that my father used whenever we were speaking too much English at home. And we were never exactly sure where the term came from. It was just kind of, he would, you know, if the conversation between my siblings and, you know, any guests we had at the house got a little too Englishy, he would say, para de hablar tanto weedy weedy. And so we kind of assumed it was just the sound of English to him, you know, weedy,
right.
Weedy, weedy, you know.
Yeah, but he had to translate it into sound sometimes.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, it
now,
makes
now, I've since learned that the minute the title of the book came out, I've had a number of people sort of get back to me and send me links to YouTube videos of Norteño groups singing songs about weedy, weedy. And there it actually means nonsense. So, which to my dad, it pretty much might as well have been nonsense because he just, you know.
Oh, well, that's a beautiful connection to make later on. It certainly deepens the title of the book and connects to a lot of the themes that are in the book because, you know, a lot of it is about language received by somebody else who doesn't understand that language. And to them, it's just weedy, weedy.
Right.
And let me spell it for the audience just so they don't look up Wheaties as if it's a box of cereal. It's W-I-R-I, weedy, weedy. And you could actually replace Weedy Weedy with Babel.
Yes, definitely.
First of all, before I go too much into the book, I'd like to talk a little bit about the prize. This is the very first winner of the Letras Latinas Red Hen Poetry Prize, which is a companion to another prize that they do, the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize, which is for a first book, but this is for a second book. And you were the very first to win it. How do you feel being the first one?
Well, you know, delighted. It's a manuscript that I'd completed, I guess, a year before the prize, November of 2011. And, you know, for me, it was just having the deadline of submitting it to a prize. So, you know, having it chosen by Orlando Menes, the judge for the prize, was extremely moving and, you know, reifying.
Yeah, and I love his quote. He says, Dan Vetta is a poet haunted by memory. Haunted by place, haunted by words, haunted, haunted, haunted. I love that, haunted. And the fact is, when I put this book down, I'm still thinking about a lot of the linguistic playfulness and misunderstandings and all these things that have to do with language. And later on, I want to talk a little bit about the Tower of Babel poem, which is one of my favorite poems in the whole book, and then maybe even the concept of the Tower of Babel and how it applies to this and how you take that metaphor, which a lot of authors have done. I mean, you think of Borges, you think of Paul Auster, you think of Toni Morrison, and it's just such a beautiful metaphor for writers to think about the Tower of Babel, which we'll get into in just a second. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you about, did you know that this book was going to be about language and about weedy weedy when you started it, or were you just writing poems and then you saw, my God, it's taken a life of its own?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The I knew that the book was going to include stories, you know, in a way, and some of the stories were going to be about my family, originally from Cuba, but sort of settled in Texas, where I was born in South Texas.
Mm-hmm. In what town?
I was actually born in Kingsville, grew up in Raymondville, down in the valley,
Wow. And
really spent most of my, well, maybe a couple years in Raymondville, and then really grew up in Corpus Christi.
Pero no eres Chicano, eres...
Well, soy medio Tejano, because when I speak, I've had the interesting experience that when I speak Spanish, you know, growing up, people wouldn't immediately assume that I spoke Spanish, and then when I spoke Spanish, they'd say, well, ¿de dónde eres? Where are you from? And And I'd say, well, I was born in, you know, Kingsville, but my parents are from Cuba. And they'd say, oh, eres cubano. And then I'd be in Miami a few times visiting family, and I'd speak Spanish, and they'd say, where are you from? And they knew, you know, I was using, you know, language and pronunciations that didn't fit their ear. And I'd say, you know, well, my family's from Cuba, but I'm from Texas. And they'd say, oh, eres Tejano. So so it's this whole
And that in itself, the Spanish that's spoken on the border, the Spanish that's spoken in the valley, the Spanish that's spoken among fronterizas, and then the Spanish that's spoken in Cuba could be, in itself, incredibly confusing.
Yeah, it was radically different. My father was a minister, and the Spanish he used, I think, sounded so formal. You know, it had kind of this weird, I wouldn't say Castilian, because he certainly didn't, but it had this formality to it, certainly kind of the, you know, the biblical Spanish, you know, the Valera versions of the Bible. So it had this formality that it's kind of, I don't know, it's probably, you know, the Spanish I grew up hearing, you know, in the barrio, but where I grew up, but at the same time also the stuff I heard in church, you know, which was meant for, you know, formal. And
Right. I had a chance several years ago to go to Havana and spend like 4 weeks there. And I was living in Minnesota at the time. When people would ask me, you know, in the way that they did, it was really hard for me to at first understand. It took me about a week or two to start really beginning to understand people. But I would always say, you know, vivo in Minnesota. And they would always say the same thing. They would say, Venezuela, qué bonita. And speaking of Minnesota, this poem, Norse Saga, in your book, Speaking Weedy Weedy, it's a beautiful poem. And if I could describe it a little bit and then just kind of have you comment on the poem. But it's basically about what happens when Mexican immigrants or immigrants from Latin America go to Chicago or a place in the Midwest. Yeah. And suddenly they're encountered with a cold that they've never known before. Where did this poem come from?
Well, when my parents first came from Cuba, this is, it was 1962, you had to have someone claim you. And neither of them had any, you know, they were the first people in either family, or mother or father's side of the family. And so they didn't know anybody. The only person they knew was a Salvation Army captain, whose name was La Capitana Carson, Captain Carson. And she was this Swedish woman who lived in Chicago who claimed them, who basically said, I will be responsible for these two people and their young baby. My brother was two at the time. And so they, you know, they got to Miami, and they immediately were taken to Chicago. And they got to Chicago in February of 1962. And that poem, in a way, is kind of a distillation of stories that I grew up hearing about whenever Chicago would come up in conversation. There's a line in the poem kind of references that. They would just get this this cold look on their face.
Wow.
And I later had a chance to live in Chicago. So, you know, that was kind of just imagining them, having spent their entire lives, you know, generations in Cuba, and then ending up in this cold place.
Because it doesn't snow in Cuba.
No, I mean, no. I think if it snows in Cuba, then there's some serious...
The world's about to end.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, what's really beautiful about this poem is, you know, it really is all about, you know, entering into this landscape that is so different and covered with white. And it's hard not to imagine the metaphorical possibilities of the cold in this poem, because it's not just literal cold, but it's entering an entirely different place where maybe people are cold and the whole experience is cold. I love the last stanza, if you don't mind me reading it.
Sure.
Let us praise the immigrant who dreams of the pleasure of sunstroke, who wakes each morning to the alien sight of their breath suspended in the cold city air. You travel everywhere. You know cities. You're in Washington, D.C. right now, right?
That's right.
And how does that affect your poetry, and how does that work its way into this particular book?
Well, D.C. pops up in a couple of places. I think that I never thought I would live here. I mean, like a Westerner, I still consider myself Texas-born. I never imagined I'd live on the East Coast, and certainly not in Washington. It wasn't in my scope. But having lived here, the thing about Washington, one of the aspects of living in Washington is that you're constantly surrounded by history. Mm-hmm. And it's not only history that's present, but also the absence of your part of the history. You know, I live on a street in the part of town I live in. The streets are named after generals that served in the Mexican-American War and the Spanish-American War. and I didn't know what those were exactly. They were just last names, you know. But, mm-hmm. But you know, when I realized that, you know, three blocks down, you know, what is this odd name? Sigsby is the street name. And it's named after, he was basically the captain on the USS Maine the night that it sunk in Havana Harbor. And when I suddenly realized that I'm sort of walking in this space where, unbeknownst to me, you know, we're constantly bumping up against this really conflicted history about, you know, how we end up here. You know, what's our part of the... Most people don't, you know, realize those connections, but I really love sort of diving into them in some of the writing. It's hard not to have history and really troubled history as Americans, as Latinos, you know, have our history not find their way, you know, leak their way into our writing.
And narratives, historical narratives, have a more complex meaning for the immigrant and more complex mm-hmm. meaning for, you know, people with different backgrounds. You know, I just got back from San Antonio and I was, you know, one morning I took a walk to the Alamo.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all these people out taking pictures and on this historical thing about the heroes who died in the Alamo. And, you know, and I'm feeling a little weird, you know, because there's a part of me that, you know, when I say remember the Alamo, I'm saying don't mess with Mexicans.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know? And the way that history has been twisted and deracinated to tell a story about place. I don't know. It's just... I mean, the best way to sort of approach history is, I think, you know, is with, like, great humility.
Right.
But at the same time, knowing that sort of the story is much more complicated than it's been passed on to us.
Right, right. Absolutely. We're talking to Dan Vera, whose new book, Speaking Weedy Weedy, is the winner of the Red Hen Poetry Prize. It just came out. It's a wonderful book. You open it with a quote from Genesis, which is a quote from the story of the Tower of Babel. And the quote is, "Let us go down and there confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech." And this is God often in the Hebrew language referring to himself as we, saying, you know, these people are building this tower and they're going to reach us. They're going to reach me. Let's confound their language and spread them about. That way they won't be able to communicate with each other. And that seems to be a running theme throughout this book, how language can be such a division, especially the poem Tower of Babel itself, which I think is a beautiful, beautiful poem. And if you don't mind, would you read that poem and then we'll talk a little bit about it?
Sure. Tower of Babel. Exegesis of a funny story in which my father asked for change. Change being menudo for Cubans, menudo being tripe soup for Mexicans. It is 1966 in Dallas, Texas. My father makes his request to the owner of a Mexican restaurant, who is delighted to comply and ask how much menudo he'd like. My father replies, $5 worth. This is 1966, and the owner asks if my father brought a container to carry home $5 worth. Considering it a joke, my father smiles and replies, "I'll carry it in my hand." Thinking of the gallons, the owner is not amused and insists on a container. Then the shouting commences, as neither man can be convinced he is not dealing with an idiot. My father keeps pointing to his palm while the owner makes the shape of a vessel, and they grow angrier with each other. Finally, one of my father's friends rescues him from the exchange, takes him aside, and explains the difference.
That's a fantastic one. It's funny. Is that a true story?
It is a true story. My father was actually taking classes at SMU, Southern Methodist University in Dallas, and they went to a Mexican restaurant. And, this actually would have been a year before I was born. So I heard these stories growing up. This is one of the stories Dad would use whenever strange problems with language or translations would come up. You know, strangely enough, I did not grow up with menudo meaning change. I mean, you know, menudo was...
tripe soup. Yeah, that's it. That's really interesting, though, because your book, you know, and many times there's like that poem about playing Scrabble, with your cousin, you know, where the mix up in language is being a Spanish speaker in a dominant culture where Spanish isn't the language.
Right.
But you also play a lot about the differences between the nuances and the differences between the Spanish language itself, which really kind of makes this a unique approach to that immigrant experience, you know, when Latinos encounter Latinos. And I imagine being Cubano in Texas and traveling all over the place, that kind of experience is something you witness a lot.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that growing up in South Texas, I feel more conversant on sort of Latino, Mexican American history and Chicano history, because right. that was sort of the setting I grew up in. And then I do on sort of Cuban history, you know, what little I know about sort of Cuban history or figures came through two people, you know. And, you know, later I went back to sort of fill in the gaps and learn more about sort of, you know, different parts of the history too. But, yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the, you know, the terminology which I think every contemporary Latino writer has to struggle with. The terminologies, I should say, you know, Latino, Hispanic, Cuban-American, Chicano, you know, those, we're kind of in the soup of terms, and people and media use it interchangeably without knowing the very specific histories around each one of those terms and how they can be kind of lightning rods depending on your context and setting. What I find fascinating is that all those terms and our stories and where they kind of connect and caress each other say so much more about kind of where we are as a larger, not only as kind of Latinos, but also as Americans, you know.
Yeah.
And it's been missing for so long. I mean, that's what I'm really, really interested in, how these are kind of the lost parts. I think it's Martinez Baja that talks about, you know, the invisibility of this enormous part of the population. And I think it's why not only sort of Latino history, but American history and American conception of who we are and the foreign policy we talked about beforehand, why it's so fractured.
Yeah.
Because it hasn't included a huge section of the population and how we got to where we are now. And a lot of it has to do with language.
Well, that's a brilliant observation. And I think you can even go further with that and say that it's a story of, it's an international story.
Surely, yeah.
You know, I mean, when you look at other countries and, you know, the recent immigrants, you know, the Romanians going to Poland, the Africans going to France, the, you know, Mexicans going everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
It's like all this linguistic soup is really creating, at one point, a fissure between cultures, but at another point, putting it together, creating a language that, you know, might very well, in the future, reach God. You know, I'm going to give you two names of poets.
Okay.
And I want you to, if you can, tell me which one you identify with most. I don't know if you're going to be able to choose one, but because there's two poets that come to mind when I read your work. Eduardo Corral, Richard Blanco. Which one do you think you identify with most?
Wow, that's a tough question. I know. I know both of these poets and really like their work. Eduardo's book, Slow Lightning, which was the first, he's the first Latino poet to win the Yale Younger Series award. You know, that's just an incredible work of art.
Yeah, and it's beautiful.
I'm still, the book's been out, I guess, a year and a half now, 2 years, and I'm still contemplating that book. He does things linguistically that are very different than what I do, but I'm kind of in this sense of awe about his, you know, the incredible care which he takes with his line breaks, with his sense of, you know, dialogue. Now Blanco is a poet that I came across, I guess, about 12 years ago. I think it was his first book.
And for those who don't know who he is, he's the one that read at the inauguration for President Obama this second term.
That's right. He was interesting because he, that first book for me was kind of an epiphany in the sense that I really hadn't read, I don't think up until that point, I hadn't read a male Cuban poet, contemporary poet, sort of writing about this stuff. And his first book had some poems. Boy, the Wallace Stevens egg poem, for some reason that's sort of coming to my mind, but, you know, where he's doing some family stories. And so there's sort of certainly that similarity with, you know, Cuban upbringing and some of those, trying to incorporate family lore and stories in his work. So, you know, they're both poets I really, you know, admire for different ways. I'm not sure. I mean, yeah.
I knew it was a risky question, you know. And one of the reasons why I ask it is because I see a lot of Corral in your work.
Mm.
I see a lot of it, especially the one you just read, the story about the Menuda. You're able to tell these stories with such simplicity and such, you know, where the language just carries you through the story. And before you know it, you know, you're both writing a language and a story at the same time. And he does that very well, too.
Well, I mean, certainly those two names, and, you know, I can sort of add more names. Lorraine Guerrero, the current Montoya Prize winner, her latest book. You know, there's just it's an incredibly exciting time in Latino poetics.
Yeah, and, it is, isn't it?
And, you know, Blanco's visibility is incredibly important for, like, the larger conversation about what is poetry and what is literature.
Right.
You know, the Francisco Aragon, who's from Letras Latinas, you know, as he pointed out, you know, President Obama did more by that choice for Latino literature, you know, just in a 24-hour period, as far as visibility, you know, in a weird way.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Sort of kind of writing than anyone's done. There's something about having these doors of perception broken down. And so there are Latino kids growing up today who won't sort of second think the idea of being a, you know, Puerto Rican or Chicano or Cuban, Dominican, you know, and wanting to be a writer. That was not my experience growing up. There were a few writers that I knew of, but the visibility is just it's an exciting time, and
I agree. It's an amazing time for Chicano Latino poetry in the U.S. I remember even 30 years ago, you had Chicano poets whose assertion of politics and idea was much, much stronger than their love of the craft.
Mm.
You know, and I think you're finding people like Corral and people like you and people like Richard Blanco and people like Lorraine Guerrero and Cheryl Luna who are just writing these masterful poems.
You know? Well, I also think, you know, the political, I mean, that's true of a lot of kind of early movement poetry.
Yeah, that's true.
And I really respect the fact that some of the early poetry, I mean, that's true of, like, early feminist poetry.
Right,
and
right.
Early, you know, it's like there's a moment where you have to break through consciousness. And in order to do that, sometimes it's more pointed. And some of that sort of lasts. I'm actually in the middle of writing putting together a small course for a local organization here, the Writers Center, on Latino American poetry. And, you know, it's when do you start that?
Right.
When do you start the syllabus, exactly? And some of the foundational pieces are poets like, Yo Soy Joaquin, you know, Jorge Gonzalez, which, you know, reads as this kind of time capsule to a period, and yet it's so incredibly important.
Absolutely. I tell you, you know, one of the things I admire about Eduardo Corral's book is how he pays homage to José Montoya.
Yeah.
You know, here's a younger poet. You can't get any better than that as a young poet. But he's honoring the antepasados, you know, he's honoring his Chicano ancestors.
Well, I'd like to believe that some of the best writers are conscious of, you know, of the antepasados, of the ancestors who came before, who are well-read, who know. And I think Corral is definitely in that vein, you know, he's conscious of how the table has been set before him.
Right.
You know, before we have a chance to sit at the table and do our own writing.
Well, I got to admit, this book, Speaking Weedy Weedy, has quickly become one of my favorite books of poems from a contemporary Latino poet. I think it's fantastic. I love what you do with the, you know, how you're playing around with the themes, but it doesn't feel, you know, like it's too theme heavy. And also, there seems to be a very clear use of your religious training and your religious education, and you use it in really very, very effective ways. So I imagine there was some pretty strong religious education that you had?
Yeah, well, my father, as I said before, was a Methodist minister.
Did you say that? I didn't even hear that.
Oh, sorry. Yes, just so that we could be even a smaller subset on a census form. We were Cubans living in South Texas who
and were
Protestant.
Oh, yeah. My God, so, that's great.
Yeah, anyway, part of that for me meant going to church, you know, a few times a week,
uh-huh.
at least in my childhood. that is no longer the case. But, certainly part of that kind of liturgical experience definitely kind of sneaks into my work.
Yeah, and even using the word exegesis, you know, which is usually, you know, a close reading of a religious text.
Right.
You know, but to do exegesis of a scene, I think is wonderful, because you really look at all the details and see what meaning can we get from this. Can you read another poem?
Sure.
You know what poem I really I'd like to ask you to read? The Scrabble poem, Plain Scrabble with Cousin Fela.
Okay. Playing Scrabble with Cousin Fela. She insists if PAX and discotheque are allowed, then so should BAS and discoteca. When she cannot find a single enye, she declares the set defective. She spends 10 minutes arguing over barquear and another 20 over sanguiche. I try to explain to Fela that though there are 40 million Latinos in the United States, Spanglish isn't accepted in Scrabble. She looks at me and says, I don't have the right tiles to tell you what I think about Scrabble.
Dan, thank you so much. What are you working on now?
I'm really interested in continuing some of the poems that specifically deal with our foreign policy and the wars that... So, you know, right now I'm just diving into a lot of the history around the Mexican-American War and the Spanish-American War, and you know how that kind of history is still around us and
evoked every day when you're walking your neighborhood.
Yeah, and in most of our neighborhoods,
that's,
you know,
nice. Yeah, that's
these
true.
Very weird little monuments that and place names. I'm just struck. Almost the old quarters of almost every major city in the United States bear the names of these generals that did awful stuff. So, you know, trying to limit some of that history.
Well, I can't wait to read that, but this is a wonderful book. Speaking Weedy Weedy just came out with Red Hen Press.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for joining us, Dan.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.